Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we're going to have a really fun show, one that it's high time, actually, that we have a teacher to come on and speak about our education system. As I was speaking to our guest before the show, I have a really unique view of education because I was in a school that was extremely small. And it wasn't about what we looked like. It wasn't about our economic status. It was about whether we could do the work. And if we couldn't, we would work with each other, work with the teacher to do so. So I take a different perspective on education. I think it shouldn't be about what it is now. And I'm really blessed and happy to have Mr. Carl Streitel on. He's a retired teacher who taught high school English and finance for 19 years, and now he works as a freelance editor and tutor. He can be contacted at ksediting@opayq.com, and he has a Substack called The Mental Lab. And Mr. Streitel, I want to thank you so much for joining me today, because our conversation, as we said before the show started, is about to be honest. And you know, it's not about heat and light, it's about truth. And so I want to thank you so much for joining me, because you really were on the front line and you continue to be. And I wanted to welcome you.
Well, Dr. George, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity, as I mentioned to you as well before we began recording. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to speak to a larger audience. I think, you know, one of the nice parts about being out of the classroom now, again, as I mentioned, there are many things that I miss about it, especially the face-to-face interactions with the students, which is, you know, truly what it is all about to begin with. But one of the things that I do appreciate about being outside of the classroom is also the greater reach that I can have. You know, when I think about the number of students that I taught over the years, might have been, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,500 to 2,000 students. I mean, you know, one article that I write now might be able to reach, you know, that many or even more, or being on a podcast like this. So again, I sincerely appreciate the opportunity and I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, let's start off from the beginning. I mean, I love my teachers. I have to say, I wouldn't be a doctor had I not had awesome teachers growing up. What is it about teaching that attracted you initially?
Well, I only laugh because I was drawn to teaching. I didn't even realize, I think, that I was drawn to it. I actually got a chance to teach in high school, somewhat like illicitly. My mom, who was a teacher and continues to be, I'm a teacher right now, of math. She was involved with the veterans program at a local community college. She had taught there for many, many years. And, you know, for veterans who were coming out of the service and, you know, sort of like reintegrating into society. And this would have been, you know, in the mid-90s, I guess, at that point. So I had been involved with learning computers from the time that I was young. My dad had gotten us involved in that. Like, I had built some of my own. So like a lot of nerdy stuff involved with computers, but it served me well over the years. So anyway, I had a chance to teach a veterans class. Two veterans, and it was just basic computers. I mean, like at this point in time, it was for some of them, like how to use a mouse. I mean, as basic as, I mean, you know, today people probably can't even imagine that, you know, kids today especially can't even imagine that, but just like using early versions of Windows and things like that. So my mom actually was able to get me in to do that. And so like I would leave school and, you know, leave high school and come over and teach these people who are sometimes, you know, two or three times my age. But seeing the impact that I could have on them and realizing like, wow, I have this knowledge and like these people really want to hear what I have to say and I can provide this value to them. Then it struck me in college, where originally I went for computer science, but then quickly changed to teaching mainly because of that experience. So that idea of providing value to people, being able to share something that I think that I have, that I can do well, or that I can communicate well to other people, is really what drew me to the profession.
It's a calling, I think, and it's a gift and a talent. I did a little teaching when I was in graduate school. And there's nothing like seeing a light bulb come on in a student's face when you can get them to make the leap to understand and really not just rote, but really understand the concept. It's just, it's a profession that I don't think it gets enough credit. And it's been inundated. You know, I'm a doctor and I've seen the healthcare system change. It seems to me overnight almost from a situation where you're about helping people and you're on the same side of being an advocate to having to work against yourself and sometimes the patient. I find that a little bit to be the case in the education system. What's your take on that? It seems like you went from being able to do what you wanted to teach your patients, your students in the classroom, to having all of these rules, all of these benchmarks that came online. I was out of it by that point, but what's your take on that? Because you must have had the experience of a before and an after.
Yeah, certainly. And to be clear, I completely agree with, you know, what you said in terms of that light bulb coming on in a student. I mean, I think, you know, you obviously don't have to be a quote unquote, like official or credentialed teacher. I mean, I don't really believe in any of that anyway, you know, to be able to do that. But parents, of course, see it all the time, right? When they can teach their children something new. And when that person is able to grasp it, there's that, it's almost that shared sense of pride, right? That you can be proud for them. And, but you're proud of yourself too, for being able to help somebody along that journey. So to your question though, about really the, you know, the changes over time, as well as the bureaucracy, you know, which of course underlies that question. You know, I was fortunate enough, I suppose, unfortunate enough to, you know, to basically start my teaching career around the time of No Child Left Behind, which, you know, much like so many other government programs, is incorrectly named, and, you know, to really hide what it's truly all about, which is, you know, spending more money, but not really getting any better results. But I think, unfortunately, that, you know, the bureaucratic system with all of its requirements and, you know, various acts. And I mean, it seemed like every year we had a different act that was coming out, you know, act, and then some number is like Act 148 and Act 70 and all these other things that, you know, basically were ways, you know, supposedly of quote unquote helping students achieve, but, you know, were really just ways for bureaucrats to have jobs, you know, so that we could have five assistant principals, for example, four assistant principals and one main principal at our high school. You know, and most of them were spending, you know, half or a large portion of their time with bureaucratic nonsense. You know, in my opinion, we have to do state testing. And so there's a principal who's mainly in charge of that. So I think the bottom line though is, so I don't ramble too much here, is all of that, you know, built on top of a system that was already quite imperfect to begin with, created a lot of antagonism. I mean, that's what always comes into my mind, or this, you know, this truculence among the students, this antagonistic relationship between students and teacher, that, you know, I think students always felt like they were probably trying to, you know, sort of like navigate this minefield as best they could every day to, you know, get what they wanted, which, you know, was basically grades. And I was sort of doing the same on the opposite side, to try to like force feed this stuff down their throats, or in many cases, like towards the end of my career, when I started to think a little bit differently, to realize like, why am I just filling time? You know, what else could be these students be doing instead of sitting here listening to me ramble for 55 minutes, you know, every single day? When does everyone need 55 minutes to learn a particular topic? What if one student only needed 51 minutes that day, you know, or something really wild at that point? So I do think that, you know, that creates that antagonistic relationship. And in terms of changes, that's something that I saw, I think, really only get exacerbated over time as I, you know, continued on in my career, seeing that more and more, and especially with the pressure. And in my district, it was very much this case where, I mean, pretty much almost every student was expected to go to college, you know, which unfortunately is the case in many districts around the country these days. But, you know, so the pressure for grades and things like that, and the grade being the ultimate goal in everything, just became compounded over time.
You know, I can you know, that type of environment really strikes me as one size fits all. And what about the child who was more free-flowing, was more artistic in the way they approach things? How did you see that, or did you feel that there were some children that it wasn't playing to their strength, and because it was all about testing, that you lost people? Either they tuned out, or they dropped out, or somehow they weren't part of this whole.
I would say, I don't mind being contentious, so I'll say 90%+, and I think that's conservative, 90%+ of students aren't served by that system, aren't served by the current system. So certainly even more so, you know, kids who are already somewhat free thinkers, or maybe very free thinkers, or a little bit more artistic. Yes, I certainly saw that year after year after year. The kids who already had kind of seen the system for what it was, you know, which basically was, I don't know if you're familiar with the I think it's a story. Yeah, it's not like an article by Gary North called the Tale of Two Buses. I don't know are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
Well, it's an excellent piece. He compares the school bus to the prison bus, and like they're driving along on the highway next to each other. And so he's just like drawing these parallels between what a school bus is like versus, you know, what a prison bus is like. And I think that unfortunately that's essentially what it is for, you know, for many kids out there. And, you know, for parents, I've gone back and forth with my wife about this many times in terms of, you know, I'm more judgmental than I should be. So I frequently, like, you know, I'll point fingers and say, oh, it's, you know, it's the parents' fault. They're, you know, they should be more aware of these things. But I mean, really, I want to be more fair and say, when, you know, this system is as ingrained as a system can possibly be. I mean, it, you know, it's as ingrained as driving on the right side of the road, basically, for people. So, you know, in terms of not really thinking about it and just kind of like going with the flow and accepting this for what it is, if there was one positive about COVID, I suppose, the COVID lockdowns, it might've been that it started to raise, it seemed to anyway, more parents' awareness of what was actually going on in the school. And, you know, for better or for worse, and just saying, you know, for example, like I mentioned before, even if it's not like teaching something that with which they might completely disagree, it might just be like saying to themselves, well, why is it that my kid at home can finish this work in like 90 minutes, but has to go to school for 7 hours per day? Like I see a disconnect between these two things. And I know that, you know, he or she is not particularly happy going to school outside of seeing friends, you know, which again seems to be kind of the main draw of school. You know, obviously what were people talking about when the COVID lockdowns were finally lifted? It wasn't necessarily, hey, you know, let the learning commence again. That was a little bit of that, but what was it, you know, was much more so let's get back to socialization, which obviously is extremely important. But, and sorry not to go off on a tangent here about that, but I would just mention too that the funny part to me, or the sad irony of that statement, is the socialization that I saw going on every day in school was perhaps like the most, I don't want to say artificial type of socialization, but I don't think it was really like helping anybody to grow. You know, I think of like the socialization that I experience today, or, you know, that most of us do as adults, and compare that to the socialization we have as teens in school. I mean, there's a big difference, right, between those two. And what is it? Is it just age? I mean, maybe, but, you know, for 99.9% of human history, people were adults at age, you know, what, 14, 15, they might've been married, you know, like starting a family. So it can't just be, you know, it's not like just biology that, oh, well, 15-year-olds are just, you know, they're all just irresponsible and, you know, and childlike. You know, I don't know about that. I don't think that's necessarily accurate.
I would agree with that. On that note, let's take our first break, because I want to delve more into that socialization side of this. And from my perspective, school was a respite. You were not involved with the outside world. Now it seems to have been brought into the classroom. So let's take our first break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Carl Skrytel. And before the break, you did a wonderful job of giving us a real feel for what it's what it means to be an educator and what it means to be a student. And it's not what it was. I draw back on my own experiences. When we were in school, we were like in a bubble. You know, it didn't matter what was going on outside. We were friends. Didn't matter what we looked like. It was once you got to know the person, everything else fell away. That seems to be, from my perspective, looking outside in, not the same. It's all these teams and tribes and, you know, how can I put it? It's just been distilled down to, like you said, artificial barriers. And if you try to cross them or if you try to speak your mind, you might not, it might not bode well for you. And that was the other thing. We could be, you know, within reason and respectfully, we had the ability to let people know what our personalities were. I don't know if that's still the same way. I mean, do you find that there's an encroachment of society's change mores on the school system? And you just, these kids aren't kids anymore. They're fodder, it seems to me.
Yes, I definitely agree with that sentiment. You know, I would also add too that, you know, from my experience, it seems like, and again, I'm just speaking about the, you know, the government school system. I think that, you know, perhaps in a bit we can get into some of the alternatives that are out there, because I hate to be, you know, like so like morbid all the time about all these things and only talk about the negative, certainly, but it's hard to, obviously, if we can't diagnose, you know, perfect example with medicine, right? If we can't diagnose the true problem, then we're just grasping at straws in terms of solutions. You know, so sorry to get back to your, you know, your point in terms of the encroachment of society on the school itself. Absolutely. And to make a connection to, I know in a previous episode that of yours, I just had it here. I was listening to it the other day. The one about the centralization of power in the family, mm-hmm. that I think you and your guest had, you know, had made the point about the fact that, you know, the school itself and me as a teacher and, you know, the other school personnel have basically become and inserted themselves as inserted ourselves as surrogate families, you know, for these kids. And I see that, I mean, I saw that was a big change over time too, that from the time I started until I finished, I mean, it was almost like, you know, the cradle to the grave mentality of it's a good thing if a kid is here, you know, from 7 in the morning until like 6 at night, you know, at this school building, like that's a good thing. And I kept telling my students, like, go home, you know, go see your family, you know, go spend time with your friends, you know, go spend time with your family members, like outside of this building, outside of this artificial construct, like go, you know, go experience life that's outside of this, you know, these cinder block walls, which is, you know, what we had, which is another comparison to prison. But, you know, just that idea of, you know, the encroachment of school itself. So I think it's almost like a two-way street where, yeah, many of the societal changes, like for example, the, you know, the woke stuff that we can get into in a moment. Certainly, you know, I see that encroaching. You know, for example, I retired in, when did I retire? So this is what happened. Now my brain's addled because I'm not teaching all the time, but no, in 2022 I retired. So in the winter, yeah, it was winter of 2022, I guess. Some of your listeners might be aware that, you know, Russian forces invaded Ukraine. It's been on the news occasionally since then. But so within like a week or two, again, I didn't count, but it seemed to me like maybe at least half of the classroom windows in my school had, what are they, the, you know, we stand with Ukraine or whatever signs in them.
Yeah.
You know, that teachers had, you know, had put up wherever you, you know, wherever you buy them, whatever, progressive mailing list, I guess, if you're on, you can get those. So, you know, that type of encroachment of like, and before that, I don't remember seeing, you know, that seeing like political messages and things like that throughout the, you know, throughout the school, especially not on that widespread of a basis. But I mean, really since, you know, whatever it was going on with like the COVID lockdowns and stuff, really since then, I just witnessed an extreme acceleration of, as you put it, that encroachment of society into the school, especially politics into the school, because, you know, anyone who's done any research on this knows that, and I had mentioned this in my article too, that the one type of diversity, you know, that really every, you know, government system can't abide is diversity of thought. And so, you know, there, you don't have to worry about that in a government school, parents, you know, trust me, if you don't know that already, you don't have to worry about too much diversity of thought in there. You know, it's like, what is it? I think the last poll I saw was something like 80% or, you know, 85% of teachers as well as college professors identify as, you know, liberals, Democrats, whatever, left leaning. I don't like to make everything about politics. Like I was listening to an episode of the Tom Woods Show the other day. Sorry, it's a competitor's podcast, but nonetheless, I was listening to an episode of his podcast and he mentioned, you know, he said to his guest, just like sort of exasperated that I don't want my life to be about politics. I don't go around like looking for ways for politics to be an important part of my life. And I feel exactly the same way. I mean, I would be happy if I never heard about Republicans, Democrats, any type of politics ever again. But that doesn't help the system, right? That doesn't help the system perpetuate itself. That, you know, without politics, without that us versus them, without that antagonism, you know, without that idea that, well, we're going to teach you in school what's right. You know, we're going to teach you what's correct. Mm-hmm. And of course, it magically, what's right and what's correct seems to be from the government's playbook. I mean, I don't know how that happened. It's just a coincidence, I suppose. But, you know, from White House press briefings, right? Those pretty much go like straight from, you know, the press secretary's mouth into the Houghton Mifflin, you know, the social studies textbook. So, you know, and it's not a Republican or Democrat thing. It's just, it's a government thing, right? It's a power thing. So, you know, I saw that whenever, because even as an English teacher, as a finance teacher, I would always find little ways to get, to try to get some alternative views in there. Like my students read stuff from Friedrich Bastiat. You know, we looked at, you know, some things from Ludwig von Mises in class, just because I said, you know what, like these kids have to at least be exposed to an alternative view to say like, well, wait a minute, somebody thinks something different than, you know, the welfare state should exist. I mean, you know, because it's like, otherwise who knows if they'd ever hear that, you know, I don't know. I obviously don't know what they hear at home. So I think that was important, you know, to sort of like counteract that encroachment. And sorry, let me pause there because I've been going on for a while.
No, that's quite all right. What I'm taking from what you're saying is that we've lost that ability for critical thinking, because critical thinking breeds freedom of thought, because you have to cite your source, because you have to think about it, because you have to come up with your thesis, as opposed to this top-down approach where it doesn't seem, from what you said and from what I'm determining, is that people are being taught to think on their own, to think outside the box. It's about, you know, doubling down on the status quo. And anybody who thinks outside of that box is somehow put into an alternate pathway, whether that's special ed, or I can imagine all these other things, these other paths that people are being put on, or they're deciding what the person, the child should be before they even have a chance to try everything. You know, so if you're educating people to be members of society, good members of society, quote unquote, versus people, you know, pursuing their gifts, that's a completely two different mentalities. But it's being hidden, don't you think? Because if you do ask that question of, you know, what's going on here, you're demonized. You're the worst person, you're racist, sexist, you know, the every ist that they can possibly put on you. But at some point, do we have to continue to do this, right? Do we have to continue to cower and just follow some sort of mandate because it's easy? But it's not really, because you don't live your truth and you end up not being happy. And isn't that what life's really about? Pursuing God and pursuing happiness, right?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned happiness in the context of school, because as we all know, whether we have children or not, but especially those of you, you know, who do, how long does happiness with school last? You know, that's, I always ask people that, and I say, are kids happy to go to school when they're in kindergarten? Yeah, very often, right? I mean, they're giddy, you know, maybe not that first day, right? Leaving home. But I mean, you know, my wife has experience with this, teaching children, you know, young children, and a lot of them, you know, even throughout the year remain happy. But at some point, right? I don't know what point that is. It varies from person to person, but almost invariably. Now let's fast forward. How many seniors in high school are excited to go to school every day? How many seniors in high school still have that zest for learning that they did in kindergarten? Right? They might have a zest to see their friends. Right? They might have a zest to, you know, go to the football game after school. You know, maybe like for gym class, but I don't know, maybe it was just me. I didn't have too many like zesty seniors looking forward to learning about onomatopoeia or anything like that. So I do think it's interesting, you know, to again speak about it and to think about that happiness, because I also don't know too many parents who wouldn't love that for their kids, right? How many parents wouldn't love if their 17 or 18 year olds did still have that zest for learning? And of course, the even worse part is almost every 17 and 18 year old does have a zest for learning. It just usually doesn't manifest itself in school because those opportunities aren't there, right? Or they're not being fostered. They're not being provided. I think that is one of the main problems with the system as it is right now, because the main lesson, to steal a line from the great John Taylor Gatto, is that, you know, he wrote this great article called The Six Lesson School Teacher. And you know, he points out that one of the lessons that he teaches is obedience. Right? And that's, I mean, those are the foundations of the educational system. If you have any listeners who are unfamiliar with those origins, I think I put a couple of links in the article that I wrote, in a recent one as well. But you know, there's plenty of information out there about, you know, the American system is based on the Prussian education system and has some absolutely abysmal, absolutely abysmal origins. And I mean, you know, the not just the racist origins, but you know, the brainwashing, the propagandistic origins of one proper religion, where, you know, so much of the compulsory aspect of American schooling came about as a result of Protestants who were already here in the United States being afraid of all these terrible Catholics who were coming in, you know, who were going to corrupt society and ruin things. So we got to get their kids into school as quickly as possible so we can disabuse them of all these terrible Catholic notions. And I mean, you know, how far away from that are we today? We just don't say it, right? It's just one of those things that's just sort of accepted, but we don't say it. We hide it behind words like, as you mentioned, citizenship and unity, right? Things like that sound great on the surface, but once we dig a little bit below that, what do we see? Well, citizenship and unity both have the same thing in common, right? And it's yeah. one mindset, one way of thinking. And again, I don't care whether this is, you know, it's not a Democratic or Republican issue. It's a power issue. It's the idea of maintaining that system and making sure that people come out of it thinking the same thing about many things, but especially about government, right? That basically the United States government is, if not infallible, they made a couple mistakes, you know, they dropped an atomic bomb here or there. But besides that, they're pretty much on the side of right, right? Most of the time, if the U.S. is doing it, if quote unquote, we are doing it, which again, I learned to despise that pronoun over time, then it must be good, right? It must be right. And I, you know, we don't need to turn this into a, you know, a referendum on current issues, but I think we can all look around, right, and see how prevalent that mindset is today, where, or from 2001. I mean, I remember the, and I'm sure you do as well, right, the absolute fervor that many of us, I include myself in that, got caught up in after 9/11. And, you know, how much of that was due to my involvement in the public school system, you know, for 16 years if you count college, mm-hmm. prior to that, right? How much of my response to things throughout my life has been a result of that system and a result of that propaganda? And I don't know, it leaves me with a very bad taste in my mouth to think about that and what that continues to do to students today, especially in terms of, and again, not to even, I'll just mention on a side note, you know, I'll use this example like of quote unquote woke issues, right? That certainly we see infiltrating schools. But as I point out, I think in a different article, that I don't necessarily have a problem with, you know, people who want to believe in those things, you know, and believe in whatever falls under that category of, you know, woke ideas. I don't really care, right? I mean, the only reason that it matters to me is that if it's being forced on people, and in the same way, I don't want religion forced on people, right? I don't want anything forced on people, you know, if I could have my druthers. So it's not, again, it's not just like a left or right issue that, oh, you know, this guy, he's just, you know, he's right wing and he's happy to say, no. Like I'm on the side of voluntarism. I don't want anything forced on, you know, kids, obviously, you know, besides things to, you know, protect very young kids maybe. But I mean, I think the problem for many people is that because the system is predicated on force, that means that, you know, we're always basically like fighting over this gun in the room. I always think about that analogy that, you know, I see like in where I live, it's a fairly conservative area. So there, you know, a lot of people had yard signs saying things like stop the woke agenda. And when I see that, I think, okay, like that's nice, but why do you need to stop it? Well, because it's being taught to kids in a forced system, right? That you have to pay for whether you like it or not. If you didn't have to pay for it and your kids weren't being taught that, you probably don't need the yard sign, right? Like, you know, just in the same way that I don't really care what TV shows people watch. You know, I don't have yard signs saying like, oh, down with the, you know, Kardashians or whatever. Like, why do I care? But as soon as it involves force, right, and like taking money from people against their will to pay for these things that they may disagree with, well, yeah, then we have a problem.
I agree with that. But I think there's also an underlying psychological operation going on with this, because the woke agenda makes everybody a victim. It's inherent in the person. It's what they are. You can't change being a woman or a mom. You can't change being a woman or a man or black or white or whatever. But this agenda of, because you look a certain way, you have an inability to succeed. Somebody has to help you. Somebody did it to you. That's my main problem with the woke agenda, is that it creates this cognitive dissonance. Children are innocent. So to say that a child, because of what they look like, is a perpetrator and one's a victim, it takes away their essence, what makes them human and what makes them an individual. And I really find that, to me, that is the biggest tragedy, travesty, the whole nine yards. And someone stands to gain from this attack on children and our society. And it's not, if we would just wake up and realize that we all do want the same thing. I agree with you. Freedom of choice, freedom to pursue your gifts and talents without hurting other people. No one should be able to tell you you have a limitation, or you should step back and let somebody take the lead because of what you look like. I'm all for meritocracy, right? If you're good enough to do something, then you should be rewarded for it, irrespective of where you came from and what you look like. And that's against society, don't you think? Because society is all about, or government-based is about putting fingers on the scale so you can control behavior. You cannot control behavior if someone's going to say, I'm big enough to do X, Y, and Z, I'm going to do it, right? I mean, if education allowed children and teens and young adults to pursue that, I believe we'd have a better society.
Well, I completely agree with you. I think that you touched on a very important point. I just saw this fantastic quote the other day, and I haven't been able to verify it. I think it's from Voltaire, and he said, "It is not inequality which is the great misfortune; it is dependence." And I thought, "Wow, that's pretty profound." And I think that it speaks quite well, or poorly, however you look at it, to what goes on in the system. And frankly, I mean, I think that from my experience, I kind of trace this through and see the dependence that the system on which it's built, on which it relies, and that it continues to propagate. The idea, like, you know, all of the woke mindset and the outgrowths from that, I think, is really, when you think about it, it's like a very natural progression from what the system has always been. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, sort of like if we, you know, maybe like 100 years from now, we'll be able to look back on this and say, well, yeah, obviously, like, what would we have thought was going to happen with a system like that, that was already predicated on dependence to begin with? Like, well, they're going to start telling people that they're victims, and they're going to start telling, you know, and especially they're going to start breaking people down even more so by group, you know, especially arbitrary groupings that, well, supposedly, remember, you know, 60 years ago, we stopped caring about race, except today when, you know, that's like, I can't even read a movie review without them mentioning, you know, the race of every actor in the movie.
Yeah.
And is that the proper term, actor X, or, you know, I don't even know what the terms are anymore. So I think it's just, unfortunately, it's just a standard outgrowth or a very logical outgrowth of a system based on dependence that, you know, when kids are taught to like sit there and wait for the teacher to tell you what to do, you're like, what happens if the teacher doesn't show up to class today? We're just going to like sit there and stare at the wall for 10 minutes, you know, until somebody decides that it's time to start like swinging from the ceiling or something. But, you know, this idea that we're teaching obedience and dependence, yeah, I think, of course, that's good. That's going to lead to some of these somewhat, shall I say, less than stellar ideas, you know, that we see being bandied about today. And so, yeah, like, I want to get to the core of striking the root of the issue, which is that obedience and that dependence. And I think one way to do that is to give kids and, you know, by extension, parents more options, right? And I shouldn't even say give, see, because that's even like a dependence mindset, right? That like, I have to do this for you. No, what I want to do is, I should say, remove the barriers. And, you know, whether that's the barriers of school taxes, whether that's the barriers of restrictions on homeschooling that, you know, some areas still have, or any, right? Anything that stands in the way of parents and students choosing for themselves the best way to learn. Because, you know, certainly, you know, if there's one message that I would leave people with too, is that, and I'd be happy to debate this with anyone, is that schooling is not learning, right? Schooling is not education. Schooling for most people is housing. Schooling for most people, and I say this, you know, for parents, I've spoken to some, you know, who said basically this, like, schooling is a convenient place to put your kids during the day so that you can go to work. You know, and like I asked one parent, for example, like, why they live like half a mile away from the school, yet his kids are taking the school bus instead of his driving. Mm-hmm. Right? So like, why do you need to have taxpayers pay for that bus instead of, you know, you're driving your kid? And he just said, well, it's convenient, right? I have three kids, they leave at different times and it's more convenient. So, you know, unfortunately, right? See, it's that dependence mindset that carries us all the way through adulthood too, that I don't look at it like I'm stealing from my neighbors, right? Like, what's the big deal? I mean, the school bus comes by, I put my kids on it, and right, it's, you know, I pay for it. But, you know, of course, as I point out in my article, when the average cost of school, and again, I always find that people find this, if they don't know already, to be a little bit surprising, is that, you know, the average cost of per pupil in the United States is over $16,000 per student. I mean, $16,000, and that's just average. So like where I live, it's over $22,000 per student for government school. And I mean, the average cost of private school in the United States, I think some people are even more surprised by that, is only $12,000 per student. So like something is amiss here.
Indeed.
That it's okay to, you know, to accept that, you know, basically to expropriate that money from your neighbors and to become dependent on that, because like, I don't, you know, I would just, you know, go by what I pay in school taxes. Like I pay about $5,000 per year in school taxes. And so, you know, I assume the people around me with similar houses pay about the same. So like we can do the math, right? That's not even a quarter for one kid to go to school in the district where I live. So, you know, I see plenty of families with two or three kids. I mean, so you're $60,000 and they're only paying about five, you know, to send their kids there. So, you know, and for special education, depending on the district, sometimes that increases the cost by twofold. So it might be, you know, $30,000 or $40,000, you know, per student for special education services. So again, sorry, I'm going on and on again about this, but you know, this idea of dependence is, you know, so near and dear to my heart, because I do think it's such an important issue, because it's something that infiltrates us very young when we're in the system, and then we carry it forward into adulthood, and we just, you know, sort of like accept what's going on around us with things like taxes and other things that ordinarily we might look at critically, as you pointed out before, that critical thinking idea, and say like, well, wait a minute, I teach my kids all the time that stealing is wrong, but every day when they go to school, that's being paid for with, oh, that's right, stealing. Something's amiss there again.
I mean, this, you know, I'm going to take a break in a minute, in a second, actually, but what you just laid out, this is something that we're letting happen passively. And I mean, maybe you're right in terms of being stuck in home during the COVID lockdowns. Parents finally got to see where their money was going, and it wasn't very good. And let's take a break, because I want to talk about solutions about, we mentioned homeschooling, but there are other options. And I want parents to know that you're not stuck if you don't want to be. So let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Carl Streitel, and you can go to his website, mentallab.substack.com. He's written many awesome articles, and one of the ones we're speaking about is the government schools are propaganda machines, and he writes for the Mises Institute. So before the break, you did a wonderful job of laying out the fact that we're being passive and being taken advantage of. What can parents do now that if they are unhappy with the way that their child is being indoctrinated in this system? I've heard of micro schools. I've heard of homeschooling, but I've also heard that the curricula is pretty much the same, whether the person is in public schools or not. What's your take on thinking, getting out of this system if you can?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say, I forgot to mention this early on when we started, which is I'm so appreciative of the title of your podcast, because like I said, many, many rambles ago, I want to be solutions focused, right? I think that's one of the hardest things to do is to find those solutions, especially practical ones. You know, I write about theory all the time, which I think there's a place for that. You know, certainly otherwise I wouldn't do it. Hopefully people care about that too, mm-hmm. But it is so important to focus on solutions. So to your point, what else can we do? Well, I'll point out one of the things that I see all the time, and I just had a conversation about this the other day, which is, I think a lot of times for parents, when they say, okay, things aren't going well for my student in, you know, local government school, so what's our next option going to be? I know, let's go to a private school. Okay, fine. But as you pointed out, what do we end up in the private school? Well, we end up with a student going somewhere probably relatively against his or her will for about 7 hours a day. We're going to be out of the home. We're going to have a curriculum generally still decided on by other people. And there's going to be a bell schedule, and it's going to look an awful lot like government school, except for one difference. And it is an important difference, but what's the main difference is that we can kick people out, right? So we don't have like quite as many discipline problems in a private school usually, because we can actually, send people away and get rid of them if they're causing too much of a disruption. Okay. And on a side note, I think that is an important element, and I wish, government schools could do that too. But in terms of, real solutions for students, I think that's where there has been an absolute, I'm just blown away the more I read about this every day. And I'd encourage your listeners, if they're unfamiliar with a woman named Carrie McDonald, she writes for FEE, the Foundation for Economic Education, as well as some other publications, but I'm on her email list. So, and she sends out, I think it's weekly, but she does a lot with alternative schooling. And she actually just wrote a book a year or two ago about alternative school options. So I'm going to shamelessly steal some information from her to share right now. But I'd strongly encourage your listeners to go and get more information from her. And it's Carrie with a K, and I think it's McDonald, like McDonald. But again, she writes for FEE. And so one of the things she does mention, yes, as you said, Dr. George, about micro schools. And if your listeners are unfamiliar with those, or if anybody is, just kind of has a vague notion, basically micro schools are, like the name implies, they're smaller schools. And oftentimes they're started by entrepreneurs, people who, are dissatisfied with the standard school system for whatever reason. And sometimes they'll just start them in like their living room or something. And generally cater to oftentimes like fewer than a dozen students maybe. So one of the things you'll get with a micro school almost always is much more personalized attention, kind of like what you were talking about with your own experience, Dr. George. And that, 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 4-to-1, 5-to-1, maybe at the most, teacher-student ratio. And so right there, that's going to be a little bit different. Now, as you mentioned, fortunately, unfortunately, it depends on your perspective. There are plenty of schools out there, micro or otherwise, that are still following the government school playbook for whatever reason. A lot of it probably like that parent I talked about with the bus, it's comfortable. Hey, look, it's there, right? Like Houghton Mifflin was offering this to us. Hey, let's use it, right? It's convenient. And I did that as a teacher, so I don't fault people too much. But one of the great parts about these micro schools is that they're generally, I don't want to say easy to start because I've never done it myself. And so I don't, I'm frankly in awe of people who do, but a heck of a lot easier to start than, like opening up a new government high school, for example, right? So right there, that lends itself to the creativity of the market, to the creativity of the entrepreneur. We were talking about freeing students to do what they want. Well, micro schools, in a sense, free entrepreneurs to cater to different types of students, different learning needs. Sometimes, even like different ethnic or social groups that, there are many micro schools, for example, that open up in poorer areas. So they cater specifically, to lower income students, lower income families, and vice versa. So I think that variety lends itself to different curricula as well. So I know that there, for example, there is some micro school, they call them micro school academies, and some of them are parts of these micro school networks, for example. And so what ends up happening is you can open up a school through this network and you can use their curricula, or you can open up a micro school on your own and pick something different. Like for example, I've read about some micro schools, Carrie McDonald has covered these as well, that use materials from a variety of sources. They might use materials from Khan Academy. Some of them are teacher created. Some of them are maybe more standard to public schools. Some micro schools are outdoor based. I believe there was one in Texas that that Carrie McDonald had just written about. That's, I think it's called like the wilderness school or the outdoor school or something like that. And they meet 3 or 4 times a week and their learning is all outdoors. So I guess I'm giving all those examples kind of like in a scattershot approach to point out that I think, you know, if parents rightly have concerns about, well, hey, you know, I'm leaving, I want my kid to leave, or, you know, my student, hopefully him or herself wants to leave this school and I'm looking for another option. I just don't want to, you know, go from, you know, public school to this other school, whatever it's called, that's basically just going to be the same thing, or, you know, we're going to be learning the same thing or in the same way. I think I would somewhat allay some of those concerns by just mentioning that variety. And sort of like going to the grocery store, right? That's saying like, oh, you know, I didn't like this particular food. So I'm afraid like the next time I go to the store, I'm just going to end up with something that's basically the same. Well, you know, we don't really have that concern when we go to the grocery store because there's so much variety, right? Because entrepreneurs are free to produce, you know, to a certain extent, whatever types of food that they want, that the consumers actually are going to buy. So this micro school, you know, call it what you want, but this learning revolution, I would call it, lends itself to variety, lends itself to what students want. Because these schools, unlike the government schools, aren't going to stay open if they don't cater to what the parents and the students want, right? I mean, you can't keep a school of 8 kids open. I mean, that's got to be a shoestring budget to begin with, let alone if people are dissatisfied, mm-hmm. right? So you can't have all this turnover, people being dissatisfied all the time and complaining about things. So you're going to do whatever you can, right, to make sure that this caters to what those students need. And so I think that, you know, for a student, for example, parents maybe who, you know, are at their wit's end, I met many of them who are at their absolute wit's end and asking me as a teacher and principal saying like, what, he just, you know, my student, he or she just doesn't want to learn. Just doesn't, he comes home every day, he doesn't want to do homework. What should I do? And I'm sitting there thinking, I don't know. How should I know? Like, I don't have the answer to that question. I certainly empathize with you, but empathy isn't going to get the job done. So what if there were a micro school down the street from you that catered to students like that? What if the school advertised itself as, you know, students who are disinterested in school, come to us. Like, we will make you love learning. Or see, oops, I'm using the obedience language again, make you. We will help you to love learning. We will reignite, there you go, there's a good marketing term. We will reignite your love of learning. I mean, as a parent, if my kid didn't want to do homework and I cared about that, I would look at that as a godsend. Yeah. And I would look at that school and say, let's go give it a try. And I think that's the mindset that I hope, you know, I could give to parents with this education revolution is if we had more freedom and we had more, I think, of less fear to try these options, you know, for our students and to realize that just because you take a student out of a public school and put him or her into a different school, well, that doesn't have to be the be all and end all either, right? Why can't there be a third option or a fourth option? I mean, you know, why can't we continue to try things until we find something that works for the student, or even better? Why can't we cobble together several of these options? Why can't there be, you know, this school for 2 days a week and this school for, you know, 3 other days a week? Like, you know, it's that type of out of the box thinking mm-hmm. that I think is so exciting to me, frankly, right now, but is also, I know, like, it must be very, very scary, you know, to parents, because it's so different from what they're used to. And I don't discount the convenience factor, you know, and again, I say that with all respect and empathy for parents and their schedules. I don't mean to downplay the idea of, oh, well, you know, just so you can go to work and pawn your kids off on somebody. No, not at all. Not at all. With inflation at, you know, 25% over the last 3 years, you better believe you're going to work. So the idea, though, of setting your student up with something that is going to be good for him or her. That's going to go back to that word we used earlier, right? That's going to help your student find happiness and to find success in learning and to love it again. Why not take a chance, right? And if it doesn't work, let's try something different. And to feel that freedom. But I think it's unfortunately severely handicapped by that elephant in the room of, right, still having to pay school taxes. Because obviously if I'm paying $6,000 a year for a private school and another $5,000 for the government school that I'm not even using, it's kind of unfair competition.
It is. It's kind of putting your finger on the scale. Mm-hmm. You know, you gave us some really awesome ways to think about it, and it's positive. It's what you can do, not what you can't do. And that changes the energy on the whole thing. And if parents have that, you know, you have your child come back happy and excited. I mean, that's what a parent wants, I would think. You know, time goes way too quickly, but I want to make sure that people know how to read your blogs, go to your webpage, and connect with you.
Sure. Again, let me just say, I sincerely can't tell you how much I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and to connect with your listeners. I was absolutely flabbergasted that you reached out to me, because I was sitting here saying I'm a nobody. I'm writing these things and I hope people read them. So I sincerely appreciate that. But in terms of reaching me, yes, you can. Some of my articles have been published on the Mises Institute, which is mises.org. And I write fairly regularly. I try to publish one a week or so on Mental Lab, which is mentallab.substack.com. And again, I really appreciate that. And yes, I agree with you, Dr. George. I certainly hope that I've been able to leave some of your listeners, hopefully all of them, with some optimism, right? Being a little bit more sanguine about things is never a bad idea. But I would just encourage parents again, be brave, be bold. I know that you want your kids to be happy. You want them to learn. So take advantage of some of those opportunities that are out there, because the more I see those statistics for homeschooling and private schooling and micro schooling and everything that's outside of the standard system start to increase, the more it gives me hope, I think, for not just society in general, but more specifically individuals, right? Individual students, all those students that I saw in my classrooms over the years who were bored to tears. And if any of them are listening, I'm so sorry. But I hope that, you know, future generations at least, maybe we'll have a better chance, better opportunities to learn in ways that are much more conducive to their happiness and their overall well-being and their success throughout their lives.
I think that's a great place to stop. Again, thank you, Mr. Streitel, for coming on. I look forward to having you on again in the future. You're a breath of fresh air, and honestly, we need you, your voice to be amplified. So thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Dr. George. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk Events.